excuse me. Instead, we're going to talk about the use of ancillary adjuncts in complicated pediatric appendicitis, PICC-Lyne's TPN antibiotic stewardship, and repeat imaging. Dr. Rangel is a pediatric surgeon here in Boston at Boston Children's Hospital. He is an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and an expert in quality and safety. Thank you. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, no problem. Great. Well, thank you and good morning. And so thanks to a lot of the great work that's been done in Kansas City, as well as Nashville and a few other places over the past decade or so, we've become very aggressive in pediatric surgery about operating on children with complicated appendicitis. And I think overall many of us would agree that this has been the right thing to do. It has, however, left us with a lot of additional clinical decisions in the postoperative period about how to best manage these patients. And these are a couple of areas where we still have a lot of evolving literature base and where the data is not quite as strong as the first couple of presentations that you've heard today. But we'll review some of these and go over a couple of the more innovative discussions and controversy. So I have no disclosures. Thanks to Rob, I did have three homework assignments in this regard. When should patients receive TPN? When should we consider postoperative imaging for patients who aren't quite doing well in the postoperative setting? And then should I send my patient home? What is the utility of additional antibiotics after discharge? And so I think each of these demands its own 15-minute talk, if not an hour. And so we'll try to cover a few of the salient points and some of the more controversial topics and emerging literature in support of some of these decisions. Now, in terms of PN utilization, our pediatric literature is very scant in terms of how the use of PN affects outcomes for these patients. We are starting to dig down into this in my lab. This is some data from our NESCO Pediatric Appendectomy Pilot Collaborative of 29 hospitals. We actually were able to identify hospitals. And so this gives you a sense of not only the variation in PN utilization among hospitals, but also how these hospitals do in terms of outcomes, complications, as well as any revisits. When we think about the use of PN, we think about, well, if we're going to optimize nutrition, we should improve infection rates, we should improve wound healing. That might be even before discharge, but after as well. And you kind of get a sense on the hospital level that increased utilization of PN is not associated with better outcomes. And if we look at these, we compare the groups, we stratify by utilization, we propensity match, and we also adjust for things like length of stay and other factors which may lead to increased PN utilization, such as lower BMI, we really don't see an increase in outcomes or an improvement in outcomes in hospitals that are more aggressive with using PN, again, ranging anywhere from 0 to 30% for their complicated patients. Now, this has implications for the value proposition as well. When we think about hospitals and how much it costs to treat pediatric appendicitis, what sometimes we typically don't appreciate is just how expensive PN is, particularly when it requires PICC-Lyne's. And together, the median cost of children's hospitals is just over $3,000, which is more than the operation itself in many situations. So who should get PN? There's not a lot of data out there to demonstrate outcomes associated with PN use in children with appendicitis. Many of the recommendations in children's have been based on actual trials that had demonstrated harm with early and intensive use of PN, particularly what came out in the New England Journal just a few years ago. And because of that, many of the international and national societies have recommended that PN should not be started in children unless they're going to be NPO for at least 7 days. And this is, we're talking about appendicitis age children, or if you expect TPN to last at least 5 days. And these are children who may be malnourished or have other comorbidities at the time of presentation. Now, again, there is very little data to show what if additional TMN actually improves outcomes, but there have been a couple of studies in the pediatric literature to try to identify which children may meet those criteria and what should be done to change clinical pathways to better improve compliance rates. The first one of these was published about 5 years ago, and this came out of Wolfgang Stier's group, where they had a retrospective review of 587 patients. They found out that they give PN in 12% of all the patients during this time. However, more than half of those patients did not meet criteria for initiation of PN. So then they took a deeper dive to identify, well, what are those clinical and intraoperative criteria that may identify those patients who may meet those criteria, and therefore you can initiate PN earlier and potentially have better outcomes. Now, what they found is there was a number of factors, including preoperative symptoms greater than 3 days, the presence of an intraoperative abscess, diffuse peritonitis, And when the lysis of adhesions had to be required, usually for adhesions down near the ileocecal area, that these were in fact associated with the use of PN meeting those criteria. However, what they didn't do in this study, and what was really important, is to really figure out what the positive predictive value of, because you can see these diffuse peritonitis, abscess, many of the patients we operate in pediatrics have these findings, but we know the vast majority do not require PN. And so again, what we really needed to know is what the positive predictive value of these findings are if we are going to initiate PN early. So just this year, Sharif Imel's group followed up on this positive predictive value question. They did a prospective study where they looked at 122 patients and found that in their experience, one quarter of all children received PN. And just like in the STAIR study, they found out that nearly half of patients who received PN did not meet initial guidelines for initiation of PN. And when they looked back, 100% of these non-compliant cases, when they decided to start TPN based on what was found in the operating room. So they went back and they actually looked at all the predictors, and they found that the same predictors were most powerful in identifying who those patients would be, and those were diffuse peritonitis, a large abscess, and in the presence of a bowel obstruction at the time of operation. But even the most predictive ones only had a positive predictive value of 35%. And so what that told this group is that if they still initiated PN based on the most predictive factors, two out of every three patients would be receiving PN, likely without an indication, without meeting those guidelines. And so they used this information to completely revamp their clinical pathway, so they no longer use presentation symptoms on presentations or intraoperative findings to base their PN. They only stick to the NPO guidelines after 7 days. And so again, the literature is fairly scant, but from what we know already, we know that outcomes for complicated appendicitis do not appear to be better at institutions who are very intensive with their PN utilization. Clinical presentation and OR findings have very poor positive predictive value for identifying patients who will meet established PN criteria. And initiation of PN in healthy children should not be based on what's found in the operating room and should not be based on clinical presentation, because that would lead to a lot of unindicated use. So moving on to postoperative imaging. So patients not doing well, they have a fever, they have persistent pain, so when should we image these children? So this is another area of the literature which is still very scant in terms of its supportive data on when you should time this. I will say that there is a great deal of variation in postoperative CT utilization. This is NESQIP data from our most recent calendar year in 2017, reflecting 118 hospitals. So postoperative CT scanning in patients with complicated appendicitis range anywhere from 0 to 40%, and the variation is even more when you think about, we don't really look at timing here. This is just if that postoperative imaging occurred. So what are the guidelines out there? Well, the Surgical Infection Society, in collaboration with the IDSA, came up with guidelines where if your patient's not doing well, and this is for adults and children, they should be imaged between 4 and 7 postoperative days. Well, this obviously doesn't help a lot of us because we know that's kind of the general time frame and when we should consider imaging, but is it 4, is it 5, is it 7? And so there have been a couple of papers published in the past couple of years. One came out of Columbus with Brian Kinney's group, where they did a retrospective single-center study looking at patients with complicated disease. And they looked at patients who had a postoperative length of stay of at least 5 days. And they compared outcomes and CT utilizations, readmissions, and other outcomes between those that were imaged between postoperative day 5 and 7 versus those that were imaged after postoperative day 7. And what they found in the retrospective review is there did seem to be benefit to waiting. There was lower CT rates. There did not appear to be increased readmission rates. And so based on that, they revamped their clinical pathway and changed it. So prospectively, they would only image patients who were there at least postoperative day 7, no matter what the symptoms were. And then did a pre- and post-intervention analysis. And due to the interest of time, that's what I wanted to focus on in terms of the results, because I think they're fairly compelling. And so these are the results from their pre- and post-intervention. Again, looking at different time periods, post-intervention was only imaging kids after postoperative day 7 compared to the before where there were no guidelines. They had a markedly reduced CT rate from 37 to 20%, about a 50% reduction, and a dramatically decreased rate, about 85%, in the need for repeat scans. In addition, resolution of symptoms without CT increased from 62 to 79%, and so that's intuitive. We think that patients have symptoms. If you wait a little longer, some of those patients will resolve. And then looking at balancing measures, important balancing measures, so median length of stay and readmission rate were the same. So just this year, there was another study that came out. This was the only multi-center data we have looking at the same question. This was a retrospective cohort using FIS data, 49 hospitals. And in this study, they looked at all patients who had a postoperative length of stay of at least 5 days. And they looked at the rates of repeat imaging and intervention for different postoperative days when the first imaging was obtained, either ultrasound or CT. And I have highlighted here days 5, 6, and 7, because this is really the kind of the target area that we're all really curious about in terms of how the different timing impacts your intervention rate as well as CT scanning. And what they found, like in the Columbus study, is there was a dramatic reduction in overall CT rate, about a 50% reduction. They also found that waiting also increased the intervention rate from 42% to around between 50 and 60%, and decreased the readmission rate from 35% down to around 30%. And so that may make some sense as well. If you wait longer, you're going to have a more well-developed abscess, you're going to drain that, and so there's potentially less time you're sending patients out after discharge with an abscess that may need to come back and be redrained. Now, there is a bit of challenge to this. It's administrative data. We have no idea why certain patients had their imaging. We have no idea why certain patients were delayed. We don't know white count, clinical factors, and so it is a bit of a challenge to clinically take too much out of this data, but it is compelling in terms of reduced rates of CT scan. So based on the available data we have, compared to imaging on postoperative day 5, and this again, it's important to consider that this is without knowledge of clinical behavior, of laboratory rates, all of the things being considered, delaying imaging until postoperative day number 7 may decrease CT utilization without increasing the balancing measures of length of stay and readmission. So that should strongly be considered. It is important to point out, though, that the current evidence pool remains weak. Again, we have no idea why some of these patients got the CTs they did, and we need to really predict the success of an actionable intervention based on these data. We need to know the clinical factors, we need to know the laboratory data, and then maybe we can fine-tune looking at things like postoperative day 6, or perhaps even postoperative day number 4. So then finally, should I send my patient home with oral antibiotics? And this is a huge topic for just a few minutes, but I do want to emphasize that this is incredibly important. And so appendicitis ranks in children as number one for surgical site infections, for antibiotic utilization, and also for readmissions among everything we do in pediatrics, general surgery, and all the specialties combined. There is an incredible amount of equipoise in what we do with antibiotic utilization in kids. So this is more NESQIP data. This is our most recent fiscal year. This is the proportion of patients that hospitals send out on oral antibiotics ranging from 0 to 100%. It's almost a perfect diagonal line. And again, very few things have this degree of equipoise. That is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of variation in what we do. This was a study that we just completed, and this was a CPG survey we sent out to a bunch of our NESQIP colleagues. We had an 82% response rate, 78 total CPGs were sent back to us. And I can't tell you the exact data here because this is going to be an abstract presented shortly. But it really broke down almost 50-50. In hospitals, I gave a mandatory duration, no matter what the patient looked like, to those who gave variable duration, usually based on white blood cell count, almost 50-50. The stars reflect those which were the most common categories, so mandatory duration versus white blood cell count on discharge, essentially what you heard Sean talk about a little bit later, or a little bit earlier. If you distill it down, we had 30 different approaches to antibiotic treatment in these kids at the 78 different centers, so just keep that in mind in terms of everything that we need to do to move forward. So there have been a couple of studies that try to paint a picture of whether or not sending patients on oral antibiotics improves outcomes. This was a study that just came out from Cogent Sal's group. This used the NESQIP public use file, 6,412 patients with complicated disease, so a very large study. They looked at morbidity and revisits, compared between patients that went home with home antibiotics versus those who did not, and also stratified further in terms of disease severity. So this is kind of the summary. They had a lot of different tables, but this was probably the most important summary table. And these are post-discharge outcomes for patients who did not have a pre-discharge surgical site infection. And the adjusted odds ratios for patients who went home on antibiotics were higher for every single outcome: overall complications, readmissions, post-discharge SSIs. And so you have to ask yourself, well, how do we explain this? Is it possible that sending patients home with antibiotics would increase your SSI rates and worse outcomes? It's possible, but there are also a couple other things to consider, that there could be confounding by indication. Sicker patients who look clinically less well were sent out more often with antibiotics. And just as importantly, there's event clustering. So hospitals that had higher event rates might have a tendency to send their kids out with more antibiotics. And so because the public use file in SQIP, you cannot adjust for hospital level effect, you know, these are important considerations here. So we took a deeper dive, again, using our appendectomy pilot database, where we could identify different hospitals to adjust for clustering. And this gives you, again, this sense of variation. Hospitals send kids out between 0 and 100% with oral antibiotics. And you can also get a sense here of what happens with treatment failure rates and revisit rates. There really doesn't seem to be much of an improvement. If you're more intensive with your antibiotic utilization, do you have better outcomes? From the hospital level, that wasn't the case. But it gets very interesting when you start looking at the patient level and you adjust by propensity matching and you adjust different hospital level effect for clustering. And what we see here is there does seem to be a compelling argument for oral antibiotics in certain patient subsets, particularly those with more severe disease with a length of stay greater than 5 days, where the reduction was significant in about 70% compared to those who did not. So this would suggest that there are some patients out there that would benefit. Now, another question is, well, what about selective utilization? And the literature in that regard is fairly limited, but Sean St. Peter's group did do one of the initial studies looking at this, where they compared outcomes between patients discharged on mandatory antibiotics versus selective based on the white blood cell count. And what they did is they changed their initial protocol, where patients who were ready to be discharged by postoperative day number 5, so this was kind of selectively a more mild or moderate group, they were discharged home with a total of 7 days of oral antibiotics. The change they made is patients who were ready to go now had a white count on discharge, and those who had a normal white count were DC'd home without any antibiotics. Those who had an elevated white count were with the old protocol with 7 days total. And what they found is there was a tremendous improvement with antibiotic stewardship. The proportion of patients who went home decreased to 11%, and they also found that there was no difference in abscess rates in the before and after groups. However, the new groups did have a higher rate of abscess of 7.9% versus 4.4%, and when they look more closely at the new group, the patients who were sent home on antibiotics had a rate of 5.8 versus 8.1%. So none of these were significant, but it did point out that perhaps there are patients who would benefit, perhaps with more severe disease, and we have to figure out who those patients are. And so in summary, not all patients require antibiotics. I think that's pretty compelling data from what we have now. But there are some patients, likely the more severe disease, that may benefit from a prolonged course, even though they're ready to go from a clinical standpoint. Goal-directed use of antibiotics following discharge definitely decreases antibiotic utilization, although equivalence to mandatory use for OSI prevention still remains in question. We have to examine that a little further. And further investigation is needed to establish and refine exactly what those clinical and white blood cell criteria are to identify those high-risk criteria. So I think we'll start with questions at the end. Thank you.